Well, hello, and welcome to the fourth episode of the Glimpse from the Globe geopolitical podcast, Geopolitik. My name is Luke Phillips, and I am one of the hosts here, and I am joined by Jack Crash Anderson, my co-host straight out of Washington, D.C. Jack, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Luke. Always good to be back. And let's introduce our guest for today. I'm pretty excited about it.
And we are joined today by one of Glimpse's associate editors, Alexis Dale Huang. She studies a lot of East Asia stuff. She spent a good amount of time in China. Alexis, welcome to the show. We're happy to have you.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
And we are also joined by Kenneth Lee, one of Glimpse's correspondents, who studies a lot of East Asia stuff too, and has spent time in Korea, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
So welcome to the show, Kenneth. We're happy to have you here.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So the topic that we're going to be discussing today is the geopolitics of East Asia. Last week we discussed the geopolitics of Europe and how the configuration of the European continent has affected the positions on world order of various European nations. So today we're going to be talking about largely the same thing in an Asian context. So Jack, if you want to start off and give us a brief discussion of the geography of Asia, bring up the mountains, the oceans, the Pacific Ocean littoral, the seas, the rivers, all of it.
Sounds good. Well, I'll try not to spend too much time on it because it does get pretty complicated pretty quickly. I like to think of East Asia as an area dominated by a lot of really big things and a lot of really small things geographically. First thing you'll ever notice if you ever look at a map is China. And for better or for worse, China has been the cornerstone of Asian geography for as long as modern history has been recorded. So that's really the defining feature of Asian geography. And China is very expansive in terms of its area. It's roughly equivalent to that of the United States in terms of both its scope and its breadth. It's got a huge variety of environments. Its internal society is based around a pair of river valleys, not unlike the United States being dependent on rivers along the East Coast and the Mississippi Basin in the center of the country. China is heavily dependent upon the Yellow River in the north and the Yangtze River in the south. Additionally, if you go south of China into what's called Southeast Asia, the Mekong River system, which flows into Laos, Cambodia, Vietnam, dominates that part of the region as well. When you get that far south, you're in a jungle-dominated environment in that whole peninsula. Going back around the coast, you'll run into Taiwan, which used to be part of China proper and is culturally, linguistically Chinese, but politically its own distinct entity with a history that is probably deserving of its own podcast. But long and the short of it is, after the Chinese Civil War, following World War II, the U.S.-supported side lost to Mao Zedong's communist forces and fled to Taiwan and has been there ever since. And that's been a major point of geopolitical contention in the region for over half a century now. I'm sure one of the issues that we will touch on later on. Continuing north, you hit the Korean Peninsula, which, like China, has been split from Taiwan. North Korea and South Korea have also been split since the 1950s. North Korea, I'm sure all our listeners know, is a hardcore communist regime with a penchant for underdevelopment of nuclear weapons and even worse, underdevelopment of everything else. And South Korea, although it got off to a rough start in the aftermath of the very tragic Korean War, is now one of the so-called Asian tigers economic powers in the region. However, there's a lot of security concerns that no matter how wealthy and vibrant your economy is, don't go away if you're South Korea. Across the Sea of Japan is Japan. One of the most fascinating cultures, just been my own personal opinion, in the region. Long isolated due to its geography being the rough equivalent of the United Kingdom for Asia, since it is a maritime power that has long stood at arm's length from the affairs of the rest of the continent until it deems necessary to intervene. So the Japanese society is distinct from those on the mainland. It has its own set of cultural values that are quite different, and those have displayed themselves manifestly throughout its history and its interactions with other countries, both in Asia and around the world. Down in the southern part of the Western Pacific Ocean, you'll find the Philippines, as well as a host of other island nations that are generally archipelagos, such as Indonesia, Malaysia. Thailand is back on the Southeast Asian Peninsula, along with Myanmar. And I think we'll leave this Indian subcontinent to another podcast, I think is the plan, because that is a whole different basket of issues.
Well, as you told us all in some of your articles, Jack, East Asia is now getting more claustrophobically tied with South Asia and Central Asia due to advances in technology. But yes, this being a primarily historical enterprise, we'll leave that for another day.
No. Sounds great to me.
So I want to build on a few of the things you mentioned before we get to the specific countries. So one of the things I always think about when I think of East Asia is East Asia and Southeast Asia and the Pacific Ocean littoral in general were geographically isolated from other civilizations in ways that other civilizations like Middle Eastern civilization, European civilization, were not really isolated from each other. I mean, we discussed in one of the last podcasts that the Mediterranean was something like a highway connecting Islamic civilization with the early European civilizations, Islamic civilization and earlier Middle Eastern civilizations were directly tied to the civilizations rising up in the Indian subcontinent. On the flip side, although there were some ties between East Asian societies like China, Korea, with Central Asia and with South Asia, there were many more physical barriers to this kind of interaction, including the Himalayas, including the steppe, including the vast northern lands of North Asia, and the mountains down in, I believe, Yunnan province in northern Southeast Asia and southern China that precluded this kind of development of international ties between China, Vietnam, Korea, and the rest of the world. So in some ways, East Asia is something like a world unto its own on the a series of plains and island archipelagos facing the Pacific Ocean. And we have to understand its development in that kind of context. Now, now you mentioned the center point of this is China. And as Alexis can tell us, China was the kind of central hub of the wheel of East Asian international relations for much of its history. So, Alexis, if you want to go a little bit in depth of the history of the geopolitics of China and how that influenced East Asian conceptions of world order as it relates to Chinese statecraft over the centuries.
Okay, well, China actually is a very long and complicated history, but I'll do my best to
summarize it
the best I can. But one of the main things, and I think Kenneth could agree with me on this, is that China, for several years, especially during the Ming and Qing dynasties, based its world order off of the tribute system, which was a system in which China was considered the hegemon, and it was the Confucian leader of all of East Asia, whereas afterwards, all the other states were ranked based on how similar their Confucian values were to China. So, for example, Korea was typically considered the second most Confucian nation in comparison to China. So in that, there's the establishment of a lot of trade relations. There were different delegations going back and forth from China over the years in order to maintain ties with China. Well, after the tribute system eventually ended, it still has a large influence on China's foreign policy today, especially since China does want to go back to this sort of tribute system-like mentality in which it believes it is still the strongest hegemon in the region. It belongs at the top because of its economic development, its political development, and just because of its historical ties. You could see this in the South China Sea issue today, whereas it still considers itself to be the main power in the region, and it still uses historical examples and historical evidence to show that China has always had these different types of ideas and policies, and that other countries should respect that and learn to follow China.
Kenneth, what do you have to say on all this? What can you add?
I think when you look at China is known as Middle Kingdom. Alexis did a great job explaining their dominance in the region. But that dominance did not come peacefully. That dominance started in the Tang Dynasty, in the mid-first millennia AD. But before that point, there were actually a series of great power conflicts, because in East Asia, there's the concept of the emperor, the Huang, and the concept of the king, Wang. And many of the states, especially the Korean kingdoms at the time, said that they had an emperor. So what you had, in fact, were giant wars in the early part of the first millennia AD between states in the Tang Dynasty, the Sui Dynasty, and kingdoms in Korea. And only after Korean states sort of, in the process of uniting with each other, they sort of gave up to the Chinese. But it was actually quite violent. One example, the Sui Dynasty actually invaded the Korean kingdom Goguryeo, which is found in Manchuria, present-day North Korea, with more than 1 million men, according to the records. They lost, and they went back with only about 5,000 men. And it's these series of conflicts, I think, that people forget, that East Asia's very system, very peaceful system of tributary states, was in fact bred through a pretty large conflict.
Well, speaking of pretty large conflicts, I mean, the history of East Asia is replete not only with conflicts within the Confucian sphere of influence, but with other peoples from the outside. And I guess probably the most famous examples of that are the Xiongnu and the Mongols. In fact, probably the single most interesting geopolitical structure the Chinese ever constructed is the Great Wall of China, which was built to keep out the Xiongnu, if I'm thinking about this correctly, right? More or less. And it's interesting to look at that because a lot of Chinese geopolitical expansion seems to have been based on keeping the heartland of China, the area around the two river valleys, secured by buffer zones in the north, Manchuria, Inner Mongolia, and then in the west, Tibet, Xinjiang, and to a smaller extent, the provinces in the south of China, though there were not too many threats emanating from that direction. But it's interesting to look at this because there's been some scholarship on the oscillation in other civilizations between inner-focused worldviews and outer-focused worldviews. And you guys tell me if I'm right or wrong about this, but it just seems to me that that China's entire philosophy of world order has been a largely inner-focused worldview for a lot of its history, with occasional exceptions like the present era we live in nowadays, where there is increasing expansion across Africa, across the Indian Ocean basin. But for the most part, Chinese foreign policy was based on protecting the Chinese homeland and the Chinese way of life, rather than ordering international order around that, rather than any forms of trying to spread Chinese culture or trying to spread Chinese influence over other countries. Tell me if I'm wrong.
No, I think you're right. And I think part of it has to do with geography. The Chinese plain, especially the area between the Yellow and the Yangtze River and going down to the Pearl River Delta, is so fertile, so beautiful, is filled with natural resources. And when you look at the Mongolian steppes or the Gobi Desert or the Tibetan Plateau, I mean, there's natural beauty, but it's very desolate. And while there are fearsome warriors, whether it be the Mongols or Xiongnu or other barbarians or what Chinese called barbarians.
Don't be politically incorrect here.
there really was no area that was more fertile than the Chinese basin. Korea is also very fertile, but it has its own people and culture. The process of assimilation is so difficult and small, so why bother? And it's separated by Manchuria as well, which is also a relatively more desolate place compared to the Chinese plains. So I think that partly explains why they have somewhat of a more insular foreign policy.
So we have we can call it the pre-modern history of East Asia, more or less set down. Chinese hegemony, or de facto hegemony, bought by blood, bought by conquest, and all based on keeping a semblance of Middle Kingdom order in East Asia with tributary states around it. Then we get into the modern era, and I think probably one of the better ways to separate the pre-modern from the modern eras in East Asia, tell me if I'm wrong again, but is the introduction of the Europeans and their opening to China, Japan, all these other areas to trade, and the reactions that caused in the East Asian countries, and the changes and social changes that they made to that those countries started practicing in response to this contact with the Europeans. Alexis, you want to talk a little bit about that?
Sure, I actually agree with that statement, especially since after the Europeans moved in, especially into China, for example, you have the opium trade going on, which eventually leads to the Opium Wars. Then that ultimately led to a sort of carving up of China that was a result of the Opium Wars, the Treaty of Nanjing, Treaty of Tianjin. This was the beginning of China's century of humiliation that Chinese officials actually still reference quite often today. And this is actually still effective because when China actually implements certain policies, for example, when it's dealing with foreign powers or when it's looking back on its history, it always says that they've already gone through a period of humiliation, and it almost creates a sense of nationalism among all of the Chinese people to support this idea. For example, when I was in China, when I was in Kunming, actually, this was when the South China Sea decision had just come out, and many people were very upset with the United States, especially in the Philippines, and the Chinese government almost made it seem like this was an act of national humiliation, which I think really struck a chord throughout the Chinese population. And I think by combining the sense of extreme nationalism that comes from this century of humiliation and the idea that China was originally the center of this middle kingdom, then I think that ultimately creates this idea that China should be superior, China should be a very dominant force in East Asia.
Yes. Likewise, I think when talking about the previous century of humiliation, we often talk about the Europeans as being the catalyst. But I think we need to also recognize there was a remarkable coincidence that the Europeans were increased their numbers and their influence there at the same time the region was engaged in its own domestic turbulence. In the sense that in the case of Qing China, you saw a massive population increase at the end of the 18th century. It led to a strong economy, but when you have a giant population increase, and this is related to just agriculture innovations as well as a warming of the temperatures that have increased sort of rice yields, this meant that the social infrastructure that existed in the 19th century was weak, meaning that it was a state where people were already at the cusp of revolting against these foreign Qing. And then you have the introduction of opium and all of these other exogenous factors. And the same to say about Korea went through its domestic turbulence. And even Japan had their own Boshin War of domestic turbulence during the time. So I think it's an interesting coincidence to see how domestic endogenous factors combined with the external force really pushed the whole region actually into a period of humiliation.
Well, Kenneth, I think you just brought up a really important point, and this is probably the watershed moment in East Asian history was between the 1870s when the Meiji Restoration in Japan turned Japan into a first-rate world power, and the course of the Chinese Civil War, the course of the Chinese Revolution, and the development of China into a similar earth-shattering power that could develop technology and develop systems that could equal and then surpass those of Western nations. I think this the century between 1870 and probably about the 1940s, 1950s was probably one of the key geopolitical events of the modern world, and the real geopolitical event that had the biggest influence on the current international strategic situation of nowadays. But Jack, what are your thoughts on that? On the question of how the modern Asian order was forged after the century of humiliation, after the Meiji Restoration, after all these great events happening in East Asia, and how did that contribute to the events that led up to the Second World War and the Cold War in Asia as we've moved forward from there?
Well, certainly no person, and by extension no nation, wants to walk around with a wounded sense of pride. And I think that's something that when we talk about geopolitics, we tend to forget that in addition to, you know, mountains and armies, nations and peoples have egos. And that definitely plays a role in politics, both domestic and international, around the world. And East Asia is definitely no exception. If you're going to take a look at East Asia between essentially the downfall of its many societies,
Gotta love technology. Gotta love how technology works. Well, Jack, we'll get right back to you, but I think one of the Jack, we didn't catch any of that. There was a connection disruption. I want to assume the Russian hackers are out to prevent us from having these strategic situations in order to handicap U.S. policymakers from making the right decisions in Eurasia. But that's okay. We will get right back to you there. It could be Chinese hackers. It could be Chinese hackers. But you know, let's bring it up to the Second World War. Let's bring it up to the Cold War era. So after the Meiji Restoration, after the modernization of Japan, the balance of power in Asia shifted. And the Japanese began building an oceanic empire, conquering parts of Southeast Asia, conquering large swaths of China, humiliating the Chinese and humiliating every other group in the Asian continent and the Pacific Ocean littoral. And then this is one of the this was, I think, when East Asia really was a part of global affairs for not the first time, but certainly for the most epic time in quite some time, with the Titanic showdown between Japan and the United States, and the subsequent rise of China, and then the subsequent turning of East Asia into a theater of the Cold War. Kenneth, do you want to talk a little bit about that and how that shift happened before we get to the contemporary situation with China as the main power in Asia and what that means for not only American policymakers, but policymakers in all countries involved?
I think what weaved East Asia into sort of, you mentioned how East Asia existed sort of in its own sphere. What weaved it into the entire global system was, in fact, trade, the economic wealth of the region that led to Japan, eventually Korea and China, also becoming industrial powers. But it also meant that the traditional trade power of the entire world, England, which was then eclipsed by the United States, also developed significant interests in the region. And I think that is what brought East Asia into the fold. And you mentioned the Cold War. And so in addition to the trade impacts, then you also saw an ideological war, which ideology would be able to succeed. And when it comes to ideological warfare, the best case example of winning an ideological war is to export your ideology into a developing country and see that developing country succeed. So we saw various development schemes, North Korea and China, Kim Il-sung and Mao Zedong, respectively, as well as Japan, South Korea, and Taiwan with their more capitalist development schemes. Obviously, the latter succeeded, and the former did not. We still have North Korea, an example of a basket case. But I think we are still living in that legacy. We have still not turned a new chapter away from the Cold War. I think we're still exiting that. And I think we're entering a new chapter where now there is an ideological conflict, as well as a very materialistic conflict on the aforementioned trade we're talking about, brewing between China and the smaller states, as well as China and the United States.
Well, I'm sorry I forgot to mention this too, but you brought this up briefly. One of the other key geopolitical events of the last couple decades, last 4 or 5 decades, was the shift of global GDP's creation from the United States and Europe to East Asia. And not only the Asian Tigers, not only China, but various other countries in Asia just created huge economic machines that produce a lot of the world's manufactured goods, and they're increasingly becoming consumer economies too. And of course, the thing about consumer economies is the flow of energy and the flow of raw materials is important for the maintenance of those economies. So I would say, due largely to a lot of the geopolitical shifts of the mid-20th century, the relegation of Japan to basically protectorate status of the United States, And the development of China from a communist power into a state capitalist power with a huge economic engine, and the development of Pacific Asia into a series of the little tigers of very good manufacturing states, the balance of global power is in Asia now in ways that it hasn't been for centuries. And that is big news for policymakers on both sides of the Pacific. So, I don't know, what do you guys think on can that balance of power be maintained? Let's jump forward to 2016, where you routinely have confrontations between American and Chinese ships in the South China Sea, and occasional confrontations between Japanese ships and Chinese ships in the East China Sea. And that is not just determined by geopolitics. That's also driven by political rivalry and cultural rivalry. But the geopolitics can't be denied just because you have so many of these powers in a little cauldron that is the East Asia Pacific area. Some have argued that East Asia and the Pacific Ocean littoral looks like Europe did before 1914. I think that's a bit of a stretch because Europe before 1914 did not have one hyperpower the way China is a hyperpower in East Asia. But I wanted to get you guys' impressions on the balance of power in East Asia as it is right now, how that relates to geopolitics and what that means for policymakers moving forward if we are to keep the peace as a global community in that part of the world.
Well, I would say in this case right now, as we all kind of agreed on, China is still the leading hegemon in the region, and it will probably continue to do so, especially given its military modernization over the last few decades. And a lot of U.S. policymakers are worried about China's rise. They worry that China will continue growing and that it will affect U.S. policy throughout the region. For example, the United States bilateral and multilateral agreements with countries throughout Southeast Asia. But then China's rise essentially is also affected the United States' relationships with Japan and Korea as well for other reasons. But I would say that we can expect to see China continue to maintain a large presence throughout the region, especially as it attempts to have these expand its territory throughout the East and South China Seas, and even when just dealing with North Korea and how it has to maintain that role and just dealing with North Korea, and also working with the United States as well. So I think that we'll continue to see this relationship where China is still the hegemon and that the other countries are trying to figure out, should we focus on a relationship with China, but we also need to remember the United States and how we're still tied to them.
Now, I have two questions for you, Alexis, that you began to answer in certain ways, and I want to just see if we can get it out in the open explicitly. And these are two questions that I think a lot of people disagree on nowadays, and so it'd be interesting to hear your perspective on this. So there's the idea that China, because of its immense manufacturing capacity and its the sheer weight of its economic machine and the sheer level of power the Communist Party has over the people to preclude domestic unrest, there's a belief that China will be able to continue on the same course that it's going under now. There is also the belief, and I don't understand anywhere nearly the internal mechanics and dynamics of this enough to speak to it well, but that the Chinese system is so internally contradictory that it can't continue to chug along at the rate that it's going, and there will increasingly be not only economic downturn but social unrest moving forward as China fails to cope with the reformist efforts these people say that they need to go through. And that, in turn, would lead to Chinese aggression to calm the people or unite the people around an outside enemy and pay less attention to the domestic unrest. I assume you don't have a strong opinion that it's either this way or that way, but what can you tell us about that debate and the relative merits of what we can see happening? Is China going to collapse or is China going to be a global hyperpower?
Well, I think that's still a very complicated question. I personally don't have a strong answer to that right now, but I do think that there are strong arguments on both sides. There are those such as David Shambaugh, who had the article about whether or not China would crack in the coming years. And I think there are also many other scholars who have this opinion. They might not come forward and say it, but some people would argue that because of China's economic slowdown, how its economy isn't growing as fast as it used to, and then giving other issues throughout the country, some will say that, no, the Chinese Communist Party can't maintain the sort of authority that it has over its people now. However, the side I agree with more would just be that China will be able to continue this trend. I'm not entirely sure about the economic growth factor and whether or not it will be able to continue having such large increases in GDP every year. However, after talking to several people about this when I was in China, ranging from professors to students to people in the government too, I got a common sense of agreement that nobody is really that upset with the Chinese government. There are some people who will casually complain, oh, I wish I had Facebook, or, oh, there are massive social inequalities. Why is it that I'm living out here in a rural area, whereas there are other people in Shanghai who are driving Bentleys? So there's that argument. But at the same time, I think that people are commonly pretty satisfied with the Chinese government. I don't see people creating a mass uprising. If they do, the Chinese government immediately gets rid of them. You don't really hear about them at all unless you look in documents from people who've done research there, or people who've been there and seen it themselves. You just don't hear about it.
Happy thoughts.
So I honestly don't really see it collapsing anytime soon. And I do think that despite the fact that the Chinese government doesn't have the policies that many other countries would agree with, I do think that it has done a good job in sustaining nationalism and making sure that the people are at least somewhat satisfied with what they have, especially given what they've gone through throughout their history.
So there's a domestic side. Now let's shift over to the external side and the foreign policy side, particularly as it relates to what American policy is and what American policy should be towards East Asia. And this is probably the epitome of all geopolitical questions. What does the geopolitics of the region imply for policy? So in America, there are basically two camps, right? There's the let China have Asia camp, and there's the balance China and Asia camp. In the broadest way to answer this question, what should we do? What would be a smarter policy? Do you take the Nixon-Kissinger road and accommodate a rising power whose rise we will not and should not stop? Or do you take the old line Reagan-Bush route where you maintain American primacy by keeping beachheads in parts of the world and balancing potential hegemons in those parts of the world? And Kenneth, I want to hear your stuff on this too after Alexis answers.
I would actually argue that the United States should have a new China policy that is a combination of balancing and hedging. I think that given China's rise and its increasing influence throughout the entire Asia-Pacific region, I don't think that we could just immediately attempt to contain China. I honestly think that we should welcome China's rise, especially in terms of its role in the international arena. And I do think that it should be more of a responsible stakeholder in the international community. So, for example, everybody criticizes China's environmental problems, especially its pollution. And even though its economy is growing, its environment is getting worse over the years. However, I think instead of criticizing China, we should also be reminding it that it needs to be responsible for its actions. So instead of directly confronting it, I think that we need to be better about making sure it realizes that America isn't trying to contain China. That wouldn't lead to any benefit for the U.S. because that could lead to people will joke and say it can lead to World War III, but I do think that it would ultimately worsen relations, that in order to really have a better U.S.-China relationship, we need to welcome its rise, but then we also need to implement checks on it. So, for example, with the South China Sea, we need to say, you know, can't really do what you're doing right now. And just watch over it and make sure it's not overstepping its boundaries, and also remind it that it's responsible. It's a new global superpower. It's considered one of the second most powerful countries in the world. We need to make sure that it's following the rules of the international system too.
Kenneth?
I think that the role of the United States is very important. I agree with Alexis that new policy might need to be implemented because we can't stop China's rise. But I think we need to be very thankful that there is a check on China. When you have a large, unbeatable power that cannot be checked, we see things like the Mongol invasions that conquered all of Asia. If there was no check on China, then there would be nothing really stopping them from trying to create a system of tributary states. We already see that because of the relative geographic distance and sort of the relative weakening of the United States, which is leading to China's building of islands in the Southeast Asia, South China Sea. So I feel that while we don't like the word containment because of the toxic connotations that it has to the Soviet Union, we need to make sure that China is contained to the extent that they will not use their powers for for direct aggrandizement of their own power that would hurt the sovereignty of states around it. And I think there are many factors that are sort of preventing China's rise, even domestically. When it comes to economics, you sort of mentioned whether or not China's going to collapse or not. But while I don't know, and that's a hard question, the fact is that China still hasn't experienced its first true recession. And as a modern economy, there are recessions, valleys and hills, as they say. So China, when they do experience their first recession, which is inevitable sometime in the future, how are they going to handle it? Usually for most countries, the first recession is not good. Even in America, it was a panic. They call it a panic. In terms of other economic powers, like the United States, the capital that flows through New York City literally can determine the fortunes of countries like Brazil, all across the world. China doesn't have that power. Likewise, militarily speaking, while American forces are sort of on par with China, on China's backyard, China doesn't have that capability to enter into the ocean, the blue water navy, as they say. So I feel that China is still not in a position to fundamentally challenge the United States, but I still see that the United States' presence in order to make China have second thoughts before they enact a unilateral action, I think that is what is keeping the peace in East Asia.
Interesting. I have yet to figure out what my personal thoughts are on this, but listeners, you have heard some very well-informed opinions on this kind of thing, and we hope that you have the opportunity to study it more and figure out what you think on this, too. Now, Alexis and Kenneth, before we finish up here, the last topic I really wanted to cover was, what does all of this mean for East Asia in the broader world? Not only in the mega regions of the Pacific Ocean Basin, the Indian Ocean Basin, and Eurasia, but East Asia as a global player. And how the balance of power in East Asia affects the balance of power in the rest of the globe. My own opinion is that as the East Asian countries continue to be a larger share of global GDP, and as countries like Japan remilitarize and China continues to rise, we are increasingly going to have to look at the peace in East Asia and the geopolitical arrangement that belies the peace in East Asia as one of the crucial pillars of world order. Because if major conflict were to rise up in any of the main regions of Eurasia, then that could, the world is so interconnected that could easily spark off broader crises that we will have to panic to manage, more or less. I think it's crucial that we look into the geopolitical structure of East Asian politics, which for now basically seems to me to be a loose alliance of Pacific littoral states versus a rising but not quite hegemonic China, and figure out what that means for how does this relate to relations with Russia and India. What should the U.S. Navy be doing in the Pacific Ocean Basin? And how do you manage global trade flows to make sure that the economies in these parts of the world are able to keep chugging along smoothly as they are? That's my last thought. Do you guys have any last comments on this before we let our listeners go?
Well, I think the final comment is that you keep mentioning Pacific littoral states, that Asia is connected by the oceans, and the oceans are the central theme. And when you take into consideration of Professor Acemoglu, I think at MIT, who talks about public goods in the international sphere, that there are public goods that are created and provided by the United States. That is open capital markets, and U.S. investment banks all have offices in East Asia. The U.S. Navy is keeping the oceans clear for trade to go through. But as each country is getting their own militaries, we're seeing an attempt at privatization of what used to be a public space. And when we see privatization, there's competition. And that competition could lead to conflict unless a greater power is able to resolve that, just like in property of contracts. The question for the next century is if the United States will still maintain enough relative power to maintain that public contract of free and open space in those waters. Otherwise, I see those waters as being potentially new hotbeds of conflict.
I actually think that when we look at East Asia now, we need to remember to pay attention to it. I think that that's one of the main reasons why the Obama administration enough the pivot in 2011, calling for the United States to pay more attention to not just China, but also countries throughout the Asia-Pacific region. And even though I think that the United States could do quite a bit more work on that, I think that that's at least a step forward, and it's a reminder that the world needs to pay more attention to East Asia. We have all these conflicts going on throughout the Middle East and other parts of the world, but we tend to forget the economic development, the political issues, and just many other problems that are going on in the Asia-Pacific region. However, I'd also like to note and go back to China and say that the world needs to learn to welcome China's rise. And yes, it is the United States and many other countries frame it as a threat to U.S. hegemony and just a threat to the Western world in some extreme cases. But I think that given the fact that China has spurred so much economic development throughout the entire region, a lot of countries in the world ultimately depend on China for that. And I would also argue that with China creating its One Belt, One Road initiative, in addition to being a member of the BRICS nations, I think that we need to learn to welcome China, welcome the development in East Asia, and remember to not overlook it.
Well, there you have it, folks, a couple thousand years of history and geopolitics. And as I always like to say, geopolitics is not just the relation between what kings and presidents decide and what mountains and rivers happen to be on their turf. Geopolitics is history as it happens, and it encompasses all the aspects of human affairs, but with an especially keen eye on political economy, demography, and geography, and how those constrain and make imperatives in political decision-making and strategic choices. So there you have it. There's a brief overview of what's going on in East Asia today and what the geopolitical drivers and history are behind that. We look forward to seeing you again next week when Jack is operational next time. Hopefully the Russian and Chinese hackers don't get him that time. But we'll be talking about the geopolitics of the Middle East and the ways geography and history affect the current crises going on there, future prospects for the development of the region, and the question of peace in an increasingly violent region. We thank you. So on behalf of Jack, on behalf of Alexis, on behalf of Kenneth, I'd like to thank you listeners for joining us today, and have a good time until we see you next time. So thank you very much.
Thank you.